Welcome back to The Europeans, the podcast about the large and ever more complicated continent that we call home. It's messy, but we like it here. This is Katie in Paris, where 2025 has got off to a very windy start. And as always, on the other end of the internet, in Amsterdam, it's my friend Dominic Kramer. Hi, Dominic.
Hi, Katie. It's windy here too. I feel a bit shoved around by 2025 so far, to be honest.
Oh, what a metaphor. Isn't that just the Netherlands, though? Windy all the time.
All right, yes.
There's that competition, isn't there, on that island for, like, cycling into the wind or something?
It's true. There is. It is famously windy and flat. But happy New Year, Katie.
Happy New Year. Did you have a good break?
Yeah, I did. I had a great Christmas, although it feels like quite a long time ago now. But yeah, I love Christmas. I know that's kind of not popular to say.
Basic.
But I find it just great. I also just love stopping working for a bit.
That is nice. I'm glad you got to do that because it's not very often that you do.
No, it's true. I deliberately made it happen this year and I'm glad I didn't. And I feel healthy.
Oh.
It's the beginning of January and I'm well, and I think you are almost well as well, which never happens.
I am enjoying this 2-day window of feeling relatively healthy where like my nose is working properly. My son has just gone back into creche to collect a whole new range of bugs that have developed across France over the holidays. Mm. So I'm looking forward to catching those.
Good luck with that.
But enough chat about wind and working noses. What are we talking about on the show this week?
Well, this week we're going to be discussing something that is becoming more and more of an urgent question. What to do about the crumbling state of democracy in Europe? We're going to be speaking to Tom Tones, author of a new book called Protecting Democracy in Europe. And the lovely thing is, despite this being quite a bleak topic that gets a lot of people feeling quite worried, understandably, Tom has good ideas and a great smile.
They can't see his smile.
That's very true. Unfortunately, maybe you can hear it.
I think you can.
So it's not just a depressing description of the current state of affairs, I promise, which, let's be frank, is pretty depressing. That's coming up later on in the show. But first, it's time for our first Good Week, Bad Week of 2025. Good Week,
Bad Week. Who has had a bad week?
Well, seeing as this is our first episode back since we celebrated the start of a new year, I'm giving bad week to fireworks.
Oh, so you're one of these New Year's killjoys that hates fireworks. I love fireworks.
Well, yeah, I wanted to ask you. So you love them.
I love them.
I don't hate them. Like, I can totally understand why you and probably lots of people listening are fond of these colourful explosions in the sky that I see that they're kind of amazing things that give us a sense of collective celebration. They transform our skies and like shake us out of our daily mundane existence.
They're pretty and we've been doing it for millennia.
Yeah, I get it. But they're also incredibly dangerous. And in some parts of Europe, the way the fireworks are being used and the types of fireworks that are being used is increasingly causing injury and in tragic cases, even death. Mm. Shall I run through some of the depressing stats from this year's New Year's Eve celebrations to put you off them?
Be my guest.
So yeah, tragically in the Netherlands, two people died from fireworks injuries and dozens, yes, dozens of Dutch people had fireworks injuries that resulted in amputations.
Oh my God, wow, I didn't know that.
Five people died in Germany. Many were injured due to fireworks and at least 36 apartments were made uninhabitable in one incident in Berlin due to a firework explosion.
Oh my God.
In Italy, 309 people were injured by fireworks, the highest number in 10 years. And in Belgium, there was an increase in face and hand injuries, as well as a worrying trend of fireworks being used to target police, a trend which is not unique to Belgium. So, yeah, that's just some of the depressing reports that I found. But it really does seem like Germany and the Netherlands are the countries where this problem is most pronounced, especially in the big cities. And yeah, I live in Amsterdam and I have to say it's quite extreme here. It has been for quite a long time, but it does seem to be getting more and more extreme. I noticed there are just more fireworks, in my perception anyway, and some of them are just horribly loud bangs without much of the pretty colours in the sky.
Pointless.
Exactly. And I find it weird that there's an increase in fireworks because officially there is a consumer fireworks ban in Amsterdam, along with 18 other Dutch cities.
Oh, so you're not supposed to just buy fireworks and set them off at home?
No, you're not allowed to do that.
But that's like a big part of Dutch culture, right? This is the thing.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good question. Is it a big part of Dutch culture? It's become a big part of Dutch culture. I was looking into it and actually it doesn't go back so far that it's like, it's kind of become part of the culture war, but it's relatively recent that it's been seen as a Dutch thing.
I actually saw a TikTok by that comedian, you know, the double Dutch guy?
Love him, yeah.
He did a very funny New Year's video about the Dutch relationship with fireworks.
The Netherlands spends over 100 million per year on fireworks and just sets them off in the street. It is not flashy, it is not pretentious, and it is very, very dangerous.
Hey! Anyway, yeah, there are a lot of fireworks around at the moment in the Netherlands, and the police are not enforcing the ban. And I think that's partly because it's just really difficult to stop people setting them off once they have them. Mm. The mayor of Amsterdam, Femke Halsema, said that it's not going to be possible to control it without a national ban on the sale of fireworks coming into force.
And is that something that is actually being considered in the Netherlands?
No, it's not. Despite pleas from city mayors, from doctors' associations and from the police, the Dutch Prime Minister Dick Schoof said last week that the government is not going to put forward a bill for a national ban because there is no majority for this amongst the coalition parties. And he also made the point that even if there were a national ban on consumer fireworks, a lot of the fireworks are bought from abroad. Huh. This is also the case in Germany, where some of the most dangerous fireworks, such as the infamous Kugelbomb, somewhere between a firework and a bomb, are already illegal in Germany, but can still be bought over the border in Poland and the Czech Republic. This Schengen zone, borderless area that many of us live in, is great. But when it comes to something like fireworks, it means that national bans can be pretty ineffective.
I mean, if these Kugelbomb things are so dangerous, is there any pressure for like a Europe-wide ban on ones like that?
Well, I looked into it and there is actually already some European Union regulation on fireworks standards and like which categories of fireworks are allowed. For example, there is already an EU-wide rule that the most dangerous fireworks, so-called Category 4 fireworks, are only allowed to be sold to professionals. That said, there are various differences in national legislation and around how these regulations are policed across the continent. But I noticed that right now, many politicians seem pretty wary or nervous about coming out and backing further fireworks bans at the national, let alone on a European level. The Flemish Mayors Association are one of the few big groups that I found that are currently really pushing specifically for a Europe-wide ban. But I mean, there also has been quite a big political reaction in Germany to the shocking news of deaths and riots that took place there on New Year's Eve. And Olaf Scholz, who's Germany's chancellor, at least for another few months, has said that tougher regulations are necessary. But let's be honest, it's unlikely he's going to have any chance to enact any change in legislation around fireworks. If the polls for Germany's federal election in February are anything to go by, spoiler alert, he's almost certainly not going to be chancellor in a few months' time.
Maybe this will be his swan song, though, you know, a sort of firework killjoy policy, just to round things off.
It would be a bold election campaign. But honestly, I really hope there will eventually be a political consensus across the EU to better regulate or ban the sale of some of these fireworks. But at the moment, I haven't seen many politicians in power looking like they're going to spend much political capital on the issue.
I suspect it's one of these things, like given the absence of general fun in the world right now, it seems to be one of these things that politicians like don't want to touch because it'll just make them look like party poopers at a time when things are generally miserable.
It's true. And it's also really hard to regulate because it's not just about what fireworks are sold to whom. It also seems that many of the fireworks that are most dangerous and that have gone wrong have been homemade or adapted or bought illegally already on the black market. So it's pretty tricky. I know that if my cat could talk, she would definitely want to come onto the show to advocate for them to be totally banned.
Yeah. The animals really hate it, don't they?
Yeah.
Babies too. I was really surprised. I showed my son fireworks for the first time, expecting him to be filled with magic and wonder, but he was just horrified. It was like, what the hell is happening?
Yeah. I think it can be quite traumatic for pets and apparently for babies too. And sorry if I'm starting to sound like I'm running the anti-fireworks lobby, but I haven't even mentioned the effect that fireworks have on the environment. Mm-hmm. There was one particularly bleak report from Bulgaria from the Green Balkans Conservation Organization, who said that in one event, over 1,000 birds died as a result of stress or wounds related to fireworks outside the town of Koprivštica on New Year's Eve. Tragically, the birds were also a rare breed of finch who were protected under biodiversity laws. That's just one of many depressing happenings thanks to these colourful explosions. And when it comes to pollution, I saw a study that came out in the Netherlands last year that suggested that the fireworks set off in this country on New Year's Eve alone emit as much particulate matter in one evening as 7 months of all the cars in the country.
Oh my God, that is, okay, that's horrifying. Okay, fine, I think I've had enough. You have convinced me to temper my enthusiasm for fireworks.
Good, okay, so I'm giving bad week to fireworks. And before I stop talking about them, I want to mention that it seems like they're very popular, and they are popular, but actually the latest polling in the Netherlands suggests that a comfortable majority, 57% of the Dutch public, would vote for a national ban on fireworks.
Hmm.
So actually, maybe they're not as popular as you would think. Maybe there's just a very strong and vocal minority of people who back them. Anyway, it doesn't seem to be such a problem in France, does it? People there just stick to the national hobby of setting cars on fire.
Yes, and dustbins during strikes. We have other things to burn.
Also probably not great for particulate matter.
Probably not.
Who's had a good week, Katie?
I think Greenland's pro-independence movement has had a pretty good week because it's been given quite a lot of fresh momentum in the shape of a big New Year's speech by the Prime Minister, Mute Bob Eyre, calling for Greenland to declare full independence from its former colonial masters, Denmark, once and for all. Ia is the leader of a pro-independence party, so maybe you'd think, is it really that surprising for him to do this? But it does feel like quite a shift in rhetoric from the Prime Minister. He's been in the job since 2021, and he has previously said things like, independence will happen, but I'm not going to put a date on it. In this speech, he talked about throwing off the shackles of Danish colonialism, and he kind of hinted at the idea of a referendum on independence in April, which is when Greenland is having its elections.
Before we go any further, Katie, can you give us like a quick reminder about like the relationship between Greenland and Denmark? Because it used to be like a full colony, right? I know some of it because I've watched Borgen, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But it needs brushing up in my mind.
Right. So Greenland was a full colony of Denmark until the 1950s, when it became supposedly just a part of Denmark proper. Then in 1979, it was granted something called home rule. So some autonomy, things like having its own parliament. And then in 2008, Greenland held a referendum on whether Greenlanders wanted more autonomy, which they did in large numbers. And so in 2009, it became what's called a self-governing territory. So in practice, it meant things like Greenlandic becoming the official language, having control over most of its policies, things like health and education, but not control over its own foreign policy. That is still set by Denmark. People who aren't familiar with Greenland are often quite surprised when they find out about this continuing relationship with Denmark for the first time. Because obviously on the map, you know, this absolutely huge island, it is the biggest island in the world, apart from Australia.
Is it?
It is. It is so, so huge. And geographically, it feels like basically a part of North America.
Oh, awkward.
Yeah, more on which later. But yeah, Greenland was colonized by both Denmark and Norway in the 17th century. The Danes stayed. And even though this has been seen by some historians as one of the less brutal examples of colonization in world history, I mean, I guess everything is relative, it was still ultimately about exploiting Greenland's resources for the benefit of Denmark, while trampling on Inuit culture, trying to make local people more like Danes, and generally being racist for centuries. There have been several scandals unearthed in recent years, including this awful forced contraception scandal. Thousands of Greenlandic girls and young women were forced from the late 60s onwards to have contraceptive coils fitted because the Danes were trying to keep the local population down.
Wow.
It is just horrific. Lots of these women suffered gynecological problems and fertility problems in the years that followed, and more than 140 of them are now suing the Danish state. So there is a lot of ugly history, but up until now, Greenland has stayed in this union with Denmark by choice. They do have the right to hold a referendum on full independence under this 2009 agreement, but up until now, they've chosen not to do that.
And what does the polling look like? Like, does a majority of residents in Greenland support independence?
Well, the opinion poll data is pretty sketchy. We're talking about the most sparsely populated territory on Earth. It is the world's biggest island, but it also has a population of only about 60,000 people, which I guess maybe makes it harder to do like regular and accurate opinion polls. Mm-hmm. The latest poll I've been able to find is from 2019, when about 68% of Greenlanders supported the idea of full independence at some point within the next two decades. Mm. The general consensus is that a majority of Greenlanders probably are pro-independence, but that there's disagreement over what that process should look like and when it should happen. A lot of the debate has to do with the economy. So Greenland still gets quite a lot of cash every year from Denmark, about 500 million euros, which is about 15% of its GDP. So it is still quite dependent on Denmark for money. And fishing makes up the vast majority of its exports. However, in recent years especially, there has been a lot of speculation over whether Greenland could be sitting on a gold mine. Literally, not just gold, actual gold, but also all kinds of other valuable minerals like iron ore, zinc, diamonds, oil, also loads of the rare earths that we need to make electronics. It's never been a secret that Greenland has all of this mineral wealth, but it is also an island that is like two-thirds covered in ice. So the thinking is that as climate change comes for us all and wreaks devastation, a silver lining for the government of Greenland is that all of these minerals are potentially going to become much easier to extract as the ice melts.
Ooh.
Ka-ching!
Yeah.
So that subsidy from the Danish government might not be quite so needed. And interestingly, in his big speech making the case for independence, Ea specifically said that he would like Greenland to be able to go it alone on pursuing new trade agreements. He's an interesting guy, Ea. His party is left-wing and environmentalist, and it came to power on the back of its opposition to a big mining project. But at the same time, if it does want independence, extracting all of these minerals presumably has to be a part of that future, and quite a big one.
Is it these minerals that are also making Greenland an island that Donald Trump is interested in?
Yes. So as you may have seen, Donald Trump offered to buy Greenland last month. It's not actually the first time he's done this. He offered to buy Greenland last time he was in office, back in 2019. This time around, Trump's wording feels a little concerning. He posted, quote, "For purposes of national security and freedom throughout the world, the United States of America feels that the ownership and control of Greenland is an absolute necessity."
Hmm.
Greenland does have a big US Air Force base on it. And generally, Greenland has this hugely strategic location for the US, given that it is, well, physically near the US in the Arctic, an area that Russia and China are also increasingly interested in. And especially because as the ice melts, it's getting easier for ships to pass through this region. Coming alongside a bunch of comments about taking over other people's territory from Panama to Canada, doesn't feel great that Trump has said it is necessary, quote, for the US to control Greenland. But in any case, Greenland's prime minister shut down this idea very quickly. He said that Greenland is not for sale and will never be for sale.
I did see this morning, we're recording on Tuesday, and Trump Jr. is visiting Greenland today.
Yes, interesting tourism trip. Supposedly a private visit, but...
Okay.
I mean, if anything, look, I think Trump casually seeking to buy the island is probably good for EU's independence push. Like, on a basic level, it highlights the fact that this island is seen as valuable by others, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly seems like Greenland's old colonial masters in Copenhagen are getting a bit rattled. On the same day that Trump offered to buy the island, Denmark announced a massive increase in defense spending in Greenland by at least 1.3 billion euros.
Whoa.
They did say the timing was a coincidence, but interesting. And then on Monday, there was this move by the Danish king, who is still Greenland's head of state, even if the government is mostly autonomous. The king changed the royal coat of arms to stick a much bigger, more prominent polar bear on it, which maybe sounds a bit ridiculous, but it is a symbol of Greenland. And the king did say in his own New Year's speech last week that, quote, all the way to Greenland, we belong together. So he is clearly not wanting to let go of this territory, even though it's out of his hands. If Greenland's government wants to hold a referendum, there is nothing that King Frederick or the Danish government can do about it. But whether that referendum is indeed coming later this year, watch this space.
It's that time in the show where we like to shower our supporters with thanks. Thank you, supporters. And a special thank you to the newest ones, who I will now thank by name. And it's quite a long list because we've had this much needed Christmas break. So here goes. Thank you to Jordan, Jessica, Juan, Charlotte, Mary, Viet, Tamsin, Carlton, Katarina, Louise, Indra, Julia, John, Jonas, Ingrid, David. And also to Die Rosendukaten, which is Agatha, Maya, Emmy, Ines, and Thomas. And also thank you to Rafa and Nicolaj for increasing their donations.
Hooray! Thank you all so, so much. While I was snivelling through the Christmas holidays, this little trickle of emails saying that people were supporting the show to keep podcasts like this one, the ones that we do every single week, to keep those podcasts in your ears. Those emails really stopped me from feeling truly miserable when I was at my sickest over Christmas. Mm. And the other thing that made me feel really, really happy over Christmas was another little flow of emails landing in our inbox, each announcing a new donation to our crowdfunding campaign for the new series that we're making, Who Does It Best? If you haven't heard it, go back and listen to the special episode that dropped, a couple of months ago now. But it's a series that aims to work out which country in Europe has the best policies on things that shape our lives, from housing to childcare to drugs. And as of today, we are at 95% of our target. Can you believe it, Dominic?
Yay, I can't believe it. Thank you so much, everyone. And if you can maybe help us get over the line with that final 5%, then that would be amazing. The link for the crowdfunder is snaking across the top of our homepage of our website, europeanspodcast.com.
Something that has been dominating the headlines at the start of this new year in Europe is the meddling of a certain tech billionaire who seems to be more and more interested in interfering in European politics.
Yeah, it feels like almost every headline in the news has something to do with Elon Musk.
I think it's because we don't know what to do with it. But it is also really striking. Like, if you look at Elon Musk's Twitter account from recent days, it is wall-to-wall Europe. He seems to be kind of obsessed with what's happening on this continent.
Why are you so obsessed with us, Elon?
Get over it, Elon. He's been wading into UK politics, posting a bunch of misinformation.
Yeah.
In Germany, there are concerns that his support for the far-right AfD could genuinely influence the results of next month's elections. This is someone who owns one of the world's biggest social media platforms, who has largely turned it into a platform that promotes far-right views. And in general, this feels like an emerging threat to European democracies in 2025 that, yeah, no one is really sure what to do with. All of that is coming after a crazy election rollercoaster in Romania in December, where a far-right candidate emerged from nowhere to become the presidential frontrunner after an aggressive Russian effort to push him and his ideas on TikTok. That election has now been cancelled by the Constitutional Court in Romania, but the jury is still out on whether it's a good thing or not for Romanian democracy that it has been cancelled. All of that is to say that the picture facing European democracies at the start of 2025 is messy and worrying, and we need some help untangling it, which is why our first guest of the year is Tom Tones. Tom is a researcher in European politics at the University of Leiden in the Netherlands, and he has literally written the book on European democracy. His new book is called Protecting Democracy in Europe, and it asks why the EU has been doing a not great job at defending this very precious, hard-won thing that we are so lucky to have in Europe. And he also makes quite a lot of suggestions for what the EU can do better to protect our democracy and make sure it's still here at the start of next year. We gave Tom a call at home in Rotterdam. Tom, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much to have me on the show.
When we first spoke, you used an image that has stayed with me ever since, which was this expression, democratic salami, delicious. What do you mean by democratic salami, and how does it apply to the way that you think about what's been happening in Europe?
So it's actually an old-ish image. As far as I know, it comes from a Hungarian guy called Matthias Rákosi, who was a communist leader in the 40s. And he described the process of kind of obliterating the opposition in Hungary as a process of slicing a salami. So you always take off a little slice so that people don't get too stressed out. But the ultimate effect is that, you know, the whole salami is gone. And in this case, Hungarian democracy has gone. And it's been picked up in academic literature to describe the process of democratic backsliding. So small incremental reforms, which don't necessarily rock the boat massively, but over time add up to something very substantial.
Could you give us an example of what like a slice of salami might look like in democratic terms?
Sure. So if we stick with Hungary, their democratic backsliding has been going on since at least 2010. And one of the first reforms that Viktor Orban makes when he gets this kind of massive majority in the Hungarian parliament is to lower the retirement age of judges. Mm-hmm. Seems like something pretty obscure, but the result is that a huge number of judges who had been appointed under the previous government were kind of pushed out and could be replaced by friendlier judges.
So we've been seeing bits of salami being cut off quite a lot over the last few decades, I guess, but it seems to be happening at a faster and faster rate. And kind of especially over the last few months, and you published your book, Protecting Democracy in Europe, just 2 months ago. So it's really pretty current, but I can't help but wonder, have things got even more desperate for democracy since you published the book? Or is it just that the kind of grimness of the state of democracy at the moment has come into focus?
I think certain international events bring things into focus especially strongly, especially strikingly. Trump's election in the States is a good example, I think, of something that really focuses minds on what's happening. Elon Musk's role in that election mm-hmm. is a pretty stark example of how plutocrats can use their wealth to undermine democratic procedures.
And he does seem to be more and more interested in what's happening in Europe, Musk.
Yeah, so he's been intervening in his typical petulant way in Germany, in the UK. He has lots of people he thinks might be his friend for reasons that are sometimes difficult to understand in different countries. And there's still overtures being made to him from the political center and the center right. So famously, Macron in France tries quite hard to please Musk. You can see the recent invitation to the opening of Notre Dame as an example of that. These things playing out on the international stage definitely focus minds. There's been some European developments which are pretty shocking. In Romania, the second round of the presidential election being cancelled. It's kind of an unprecedented example. I think that the overall trend towards less democracy is one that is accelerating, but not at a huge pace, right? So the salami slicing example is actually a good image because it is still the case that the way that this happens is via incremental piecemeal reforms that undermine democratic foundations rather than via coups or via wars. At least in the European context, that's what we're seeing for the most part.
And I'm sorry to keep things so focused on the sausage, but what has the European Union's response to the slicing away of this salami been? Are there any good examples in which the EU has successfully provided like a barrier against this chipping away of our democracies?
In the whole, I'd say, and a lot of my book is it tries to lay out why and how the response has been inadequate. I think if we take kind of democratic backsliding in Europe in the period that I'm looking at as kicking off really around 2010 in Hungary, then you can see for the first 10 years, European actors don't really do all that much. And in the book, I argue that one of the reasons that that's the case is because European politicians and the European political context was kind of burned by an earlier embarrassing bad experience with the Austrian far right when they joined the government in the year 2000. They tried to organize some sanctions and some kind of boycotts, which were very embarrassing and didn't work very well. Mm. And for that reason, there was a lot of reticence when then things started to come up in Hungary. to really take a strong position, for example, with sanctions or with legal tools that the EU could use to respond to democratic decay. If there's an example of the EU doing its job well in this context, it's also really hard to say. And this is where I pull the academic card, right? We don't have an alternative world. We don't have a test world where we did things differently, that we could see how things would have turned out. In general, I think me picking out like a couple of pearls in a generally pretty murky assembly of developments wouldn't be helpful, in the sense that my whole kind of spiel in the book is that the response has been overall pretty bad.
Well, that's pretty bleak, but thankfully we're talking to someone who you actually also have quite a lot of ideas for how things could improve. In a nutshell, what are some of the things you're proposing in your book?
So in the second half of the book, I try to lay out a strategy that I call coherent democracy protection. And this focuses around three different things. Firstly, I say we need to recognize that a really wide range of EU actors are actually complicit in democratic decay in EU member states. And if we recognize that that's the case, then that means that they all have, or that many institutions and actors, far more than we might otherwise think, have a responsibility to respond. The aim of that chapter, the aim of that kind of message, is to empower, to encourage member state governments and citizens and political parties and all sorts of actors that we don't usually focus on to kind of pitch in and to do their share in responding to democratic decay. The second kind of proposal, or the second track, is to focus on trying to limit the power of authoritarian actors in EU politics. So right now, there's certain contexts wherein, for example, Viktor Orban's government is massively powerful because they have a veto of certain decision-making.
Hmm.
And we should think much more creatively about how we can circumvent that kind of power. Because if we agree that Orban's government isn't a democratic government, then giving them a veto over some really important decisions like aid to Ukraine or whatever it is really dangerous. And then the third, I argue that we should, across a whole series of different levels, from the kind of European and national levels to the more citizen and civil society levels, we should try to cultivate pluralist organizations, civil society organizations, free press, critical academia, all of these things. We should try to support them where they're under threat. And that can be done at a very small scale, but it can also be done at a really large scale. And I think there's loads of different overlapping reasons for why that's a good thing to do.
Do you get the sense that European leaders are starting to enact these ideas? Or is it just something that they seem to be blind about and really, really need to just get started actually doing?
That's really tough, because we see different things and they pull in different directions. So on the one hand, we see that, for example, about the EU budget, there have been steps to make it more conditional on certain performance, especially on the rule of law. So now quite a lot of money is being withheld from Hungary and from Poland. That's being released more slowly now because of these anti-democratic reforms. That kind of budget conditionality is pretty new. We saw that really coming into play in the COVID period, when people were proposing that the stimulus funds after COVID were made conditional on rule of law performance. So that's a development which I think is good and quite a powerful development in recent years. At the same time, there have been some recent developments in European politics which are really troubling. So now we have, for example, a vice president of the European Commission who comes from a far-right party. Unimaginable, even 5 years ago, I would say.
You mentioned just before we started recording that you'd had one of the events to launch this book at the European Parliament. And I was wondering, is it people you'd expect that turn up to something like that? Or are there people outside the kind of bubble that you'd expect, maybe people more on the right that are also concerned about democratic backsliding?
I don't really know. So I'd hope that the event attracted a pretty diverse kind of group. But I didn't speak to everyone who's there. I think one of the facts of democratic backsliding, even globally, is that the current threat comes from the right. That doesn't mean to say that that's always been the case or will always be the case. But if you look at prominent examples of democratic decay at the international level, whether it's Modi in India or Netanyahu in Israel or Bolsonaro or Trump, but these are all coming from radicalized center-right parties. And it seems that that's where the threat is. So I think there's also a bit, maybe more reticence from center-right politicians to engage.
As we head into this new year, what do you see as the main challenges facing European democracies that we should be looking out for in 2025?
I think, let me try a different metaphor. So we focused a lot on the salami.
Let's leave the salami behind.
But a similar metaphor is the frog, right, in the pot. And the frog, well, you turn up the heat slowly, and then at some point the frog doesn't realize that it's getting too hot, and they just kind of stick it out until they boil. I think that's a pretty apt metaphor for what's happening to European democracy. So we kind of become habituated to democratic crisis. And I think for a lot of people, when bad news stacks up, even if they have kind of strongly pro-democratic instincts and values, when bad news stacks up, the instinct is to kind of put your head in the sand and turn off the news and, you know, focus on whatever it is you like to do, baking cookies or going for walks with your dog or whatever it is, right?
We've had that time over Christmas. Exactly. Back to work, everyone.
And I think that that complacency, that generalized complacency, is the biggest risk. The idea that we could just become used to anti-democratic, far-right actors in politics and business having the upper hand and give up on proposing and fighting for an alternative.
That last warning from Tom not to let the frog boil is kind of the kick up the ass I've been needing to start paying attention again after the holidays. Like, I have been really taking refuge and not really following the news, especially from the US, because it's just too depressing. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I've been guilty of that too. And really not just the US. I mean, it seems like all around us in Europe, things are taking a turn for the worst, a turn towards the autocrat. But yeah, we need to do something. I mean, I have to say, I was quite confronted. In December, we got like an official warning from our government here in the Netherlands that we all need to make sure we have like emergency kits for if there's some kind of like major power outage or war or pandemic or like societal breakdown.
Great.
And we had like official advice on like how much water you need, what kind of tins of food you'd have and radio. I really felt, got the feeling that societal breakdown was suddenly quite like imminent.
Happy New Year, everyone.
Yeah. But I have to say, hearing Tom speak makes me think, oh, I'm really glad there are some really clever people thinking about like how can we make sure this doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So yeah, you should check out his book and see what ideas he's got. I know it's just come out in the US as well. So US listeners, you can get it as well.
You can. It's called Protecting Democracy in Europe, and you will find a link to it in the show notes. What did you enjoy watching, eating, listening to, or otherwise generally consuming over the holidays, Dominic?
I enjoyed so many wonderful European cultural things over these holidays. I like have a long list that I can slowly go through over the next few months, which is great because usually I feel like I don't have any time to watch anything. But I'm going to start today by recommending a film called My Favorite Cake.
Oh, sounds great.
Yeah, it's an Iranian film actually, but I'm allowing myself to talk about it here on the Europeans podcast because it was co-produced in Iran, Sweden, France, and Germany. It's a romantic drama that follows a 70-year-old woman living in Tehran who wants to find a boyfriend. And it's equal parts charming, tragic, and funny. It's actually amazing how it manages to be funny despite being made in quite a repressive context. Mm. And even though it's not exactly a broadside against the Iranian government, the horrific rules and restrictions that Iranian women have to deal with every day are a key aspect in the film. And probably for that reason, the filmmakers have become a target of the Iranian regime since this film was released. Mm. The directors, who were a husband and wife couple, they've been under a travel ban since they tried to leave the country for the premiere in late 2023. And they are currently facing trial for propaganda against the regime, breaking Islamic rules by making a vulgar movie and spreading prostitution and libertinism.
Terrible.
There is no prostitution in the film. So yeah, the deeply depressing aftermath of this film is, I think, all the more reason to seek it out. It's beautiful and charming. And it's available to rent online on various different platforms, depending on where you live. But yeah, I highly recommend you fork out the 7 or 8 euros you will probably have to pay to rent it out. It's called My Favorite Cake.
I am adding that to my list immediately. It sounds great.
What have you been enjoying, Katie?
I also watched a really great film. Maybe it was on your list of things that you watched over the holidays, Dominic. It's an Italian film called La Chimera. Did you see it?
Oh, no, I really wanted to see it. Haven't yet. With Josh O'Connor, right?
Yes, Josh O'Connor, who you might know as the young Prince Charles in The Crown, if you've watched that Netflix series. Mm-hmm. But in this, he is speaking Italian. It is an Italian movie set in the 1980s, and it is about a group of tombaroli, or tomb raiders. And this was very much a real social phenomenon in 1980s Italy. These ancient Etruscan tombs scattered around Umbria and Tuscany and Lazio, which had been unbothered for thousands of years. In the early 80s, there was this wave of plunder of these tombs for the treasures within them, for the statues and vases and religious artifacts inside, which could then be sold on the black market. And it was really this moment in the history of Italian capitalism, really, where greed took over. And these things that have been sacred for millennia were suddenly seen as, yeah, up for grabs. I didn't know anything about this history before I watched this film, but I'm kind of a little bit obsessed with it now. The director, Alice Rohrwacher, she grew up in a town that was full of these tomb robbers, and she's always been fascinated by them. The film that she's made is quite funny. A lot of it feels kind of like an arty adventure movie, but it's also quite bittersweet. Josh O'Connor, who you mentioned, he plays this quite disheveled British archaeologist who has fallen in with a gang of these tomb robbers, and he's kind of lost his way in life. But yeah, anyway, if you're looking for a movie that is an art house movie, but not unbearably pretentious, it's got a great 80s soundtrack, and it's maybe about a bit of history that is unfamiliar to you, I really recommend this film. It is called La Chimera.
I definitely want to see it. It's still happening, this tomb raiding thing in Italy, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't want to make it sound like it's a thing that happened in the early 80s and then stopped happening. It does still happen, but it's something that very much took off around that time.
Did you also see how well European films did at the Golden Globes this past weekend?
Yeah, I was so proud of us. Yeah, as a continent.
I like that you can take that. So the Spanish language, Mexican set, but French made musical crime comedy, Emilia Perez, got the most awards. And that wasn't a huge surprise. But what was a big surprise was that in the best animated film category, a Latvian film called Flow beat out stiff US competition, including Inside Out 2, Moana 2, and The Wild Robot, to win the award.
Love that.
I really want to see this film, Flow. It's independently made, and it's a film about a cat, and it contains no dialogue and was rendered on free open source software. So yeah, I want to watch it, and actually I want to speak to the filmmaker who made it. So maybe that will be a future interview on this show.
Stay tuned.
Over our Christmas break, there's been a lot of news of depressing behavior by politicians internationally. So for my happy ending, I'm going to share an Instagram post from a political figure that I found inspiring and brave. It was shared with me by former resident of Barcelona and our producer, Katz Laszlo. And it's a post from the former mayor of Barcelona, Ada Colau. She was mayor from 2015 until 2023. And I think I'll just read it, translated with the help of the robots. Thank you, robots.
Thank you, robots.
It's connected to a photo of her belly button.
Okay.
And it says, "Yet another stigmatized topic related to women. Another one. I chose a photo of my belly button not only to catch your attention, but because for me, it's a metaphor for the stage of life. Like so many women in our 50s, our abdomen is no longer as firm and often carries scars. In my case, 2 C-sections and surgery for a post-pregnancy hernia. And yet, perhaps because of that, we feel more connected than ever to life and to desire. Perimenopause is when periods start to become irregular. I've spent the last year where they disappeared for 3 months, came back for another 3, and so it continues. Officially, according to medicine, you're not officially in menopause until you've gone a full year without a period. However, the changes start before this official recognition. And as is often the case with women's health, they're not given importance, which means there's almost no public conversation or information. It's even frowned upon to talk about it. Well then, let's talk about menopause because it's in our best interest.
Love that.
In my case, I feel like I'm speaking as me, but I just remind everyone I'm speaking
as Ada
Kala. I'm still Ada, yeah? In my case, I'm experiencing hot flashes that wake me up in the middle of the night. I know it's essential to strengthen muscle mass and do strength exercises, though I'm still not sure how to do that at home because I won't go to a gym. I know myself. I'm also not clear if there's anything specific about diet to consider other than following a healthy diet as we should at any age. On the other hand, I feel more alive than ever, eager to dance with friends, full of erotic desire, contrary to stereotypes, and eager to keep learning and creating. So I ask you, especially the women who are in the pre, during, or post-menopause phase, to share your questions and what you've learned, especially anything that brings us joy, because we only have one life and we need to live it, enjoying it as much as possible, showing off our belly buttons and letting our hair down, alone or with friends.
What an awesome pose from a politician. I don't think I've ever heard anything quite like that, but I love it.
It's amazing, isn't it?
So great.
Thank you, Ada, for sharing that with the world.
That is all we have time for this week. And apparently, 1 week of podcasting was quite enough for you, Dominic, because you're away next week.
Sorry, I've got a really busy January with rehearsals. It's one of those periods where I don't have a single day off for the next 3 weeks.
Are you singing something fun?
I'm singing lots of different things that are fun, yes, in lots of different languages. So I'm not sure if my brain is going to cope, but we'll see.
Maybe it's best that you're not here next week then, because speaking English might be hard for you. But producer Wojciech will be joining me, and I'm very much looking forward to having him with me. In the meantime, until then, you can find us on Blue Sky and Instagram, and you can also send us an email if you've got thoughts on this week's show. hello@europeanspodcast.com.
This week's episode was produced by Katie Lee and Wojciech Oleksiak. Thank you both. Please do consider helping us get over the line on the crowdfunder if you've got a spare few euros or dollars or pounds, or we'll accept anything.
The quicker we get there, the quicker we can stop talking about it.
It's true.
Happy singing, Dominic. See everyone next week.
Thanks. Ciao.
Takusagut.